since we have quite a few people that want to testify on, and I'll just repeat that testimony during this public comment period should be focused on the science panel's work and the potential habitat recommendations that have been presented to the board. Ken Miller and Elaine O'Neill, you want to come up together? And I'd appreciate it if you guys can limit your time to 3 minutes, please.
Good morning, Chairman Burnett and members of the board. I'm Ken Miller, a light representative for Steve Barnmeyer, who's off in Germany basking in the glory of being a grandfather for the first time. So I have his expert testimony here regarding that subject matter, and I'd like to read most of that into the record, but again, Patricia's passing around the copy.
So. Is that the same letter that was sent out to board members yesterday?
It's revised a little bit, yes.
Okay. Can you focus on the changes that, please?
It'd just be an omission, I'll skip through, so nothing major. So my name is Steve Barnmeyer. Along with Ken Miller, I represent small forest landowners and the Washington Farm Forestry Association on the TFW Policy Committee. I'm also the small forest landowner representative on the technical committee of the stakeholder representatives that was invited to participate in making recommendations to the PHB science panel and review draft recommendations prior to the PHB report being submitted to this board. Attached to this testimony are the written comments on the December 8th draft science panel recommendations that I submitted to the AMPA on December 22nd, including a number of serious concerns with their process and draft recommendations. Now that the science panel has finalized their recommendations to the board, WFFA is obliged to express to the board our grave concerns about what we view as a substandard data collection and analytical process followed by the panel, resulting in what we contend are several flawed recommendations being submitted to you by that panel. Some questions or concerns: why did the panel replace the original landowner database rather than supplement the previously submitted data with data from the underrepresented areas as directed by the board? Why was the Cole-Seamer study not used in the analysis? Why were data standards for the new data set consciously relaxed, allowing the inclusion of data points lacking critical data parameters such as the downstream measurements and the end of fish data, thereby precluding appropriate analysis of these critical change parameters by the panel, as well as effectively upending the process to favor alternatives based on the threshold parameters over change parameters? In addition to this significant flaw with the new data set is inferior compared to the landowner data set, with the report itself indicating a 20% error rate for the new data set versus a 10% error rate for the landowner data set. All threshold recommendations are a substantial departure from the adopted FM, which assumes stream character changes rather than thresholds. The report and verbal explanation by the panel lack clarity and consistency on how the recommendations will be implemented, potentially impairing consistent, repeatable, reproducible application in the field. Use of and reliance upon a highly questionable percent captured statistic as a substitute for a thorough analysis to evaluate which of the PHB alternatives is the most accurate or the most balanced for allocation of error. And finally, or lastly, failure by the panel to include either the comments from the technical committee or the stakeholder representatives or the written responses by the panel to any of these stakeholder comments. So in summary, to mitigate and resolve many of the grave concerns listed above, as well as build upon and incorporate supportable work and recommendations of the science panel, WFFA strongly supports the PHB recommendation of Washington Forest Protection Association that will propose to the board. WFFA is firmly committed to a multi-stakeholder Eastern and Western Washington PHB solution that is consistent with the FM and the expectations of the water piping system adopted by the board. We believe that WFPA's proposal to the board will meet all of those expectations. Also, as you well know, the Administrative Procedures Act requires a preliminary cost-benefit analysis with a determination that the probable benefits of a proposed rule change are greater than its probable costs. The Act also requires a determination after considering alternative versions of a rule change that the rule being adopted is the least burdensome alternative for those of us required to comply with it that will achieve the general goal and objectives of the stated rule. Also, a small business economic impact statement will be required for any proposed rule change adopted by the board. Thorough and conscientious completion of these requirements are particularly and critically important to small forest landowners. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide input to you about PHBs and the permanent water piping system. Steve Bartemeyer and Grandpa.
Chairman Burnett, members of the board, I'm Dr. Elaine O'Neill. I'm the executive director of the Washington Farm Forestry Association. I reviewed the science panel recommendations not as a subject matter expert, which I'm not, but from the perspective of a scientist. And I have to say, I feel for these guys. Public peer review is never very nice. I have some questions and concerns to share with the board that are likely to influence your understanding of what you have before you today. First off, I have to say, and this is maybe one of my pet peeves, units matter. So we're starting with the literature review. You get this executive summary that talks about 2 feet, 3 feet, you're in 3 feet mode. Literature review talks about reported streamness in which fish no longer able to move upward from 2 to 16 meters. Meters, holy, let's just switch there. 2 meters is 6.5 feet. So I'm not a subject matter expert, so I'm going, why is it that Washington streams with fish are so much smaller than these reported in the literature? And then I look a little bit further at the probability distribution functions, which actually were shown today. We talked about wetted width, that's page 27, instead of channel width. The question I had was why? Sure enough, the probability distribution functions capture nearly all the streams beyond the end of fish at 2 to 3 feet of wetted width. And that's both for Eastern and Western Washington, but we're not talking about wetted width, we're talking about channel width. And why are these threshold values the same as the wetted width instead of the channel width? I find this especially concerning, as the report also indicates that, and this is, I think it's page 30 or something, in addition, many PHBs appear to be selected not by strict criteria, but because they would make it through the concurrence process. So there's a lot of ways to think about that, but since the agencies must agree to or concur with these end of fish habitat, it suggests these water type modification forms with concurrence are already conservative with respect to moving that end of fish habitat further upstream than may be necessary. Let's go to statistics. Thresholds are not a model. Doesn't sound like any statistical analysis actually occurred listening to the presentation this morning. And I think in Representative Davies, I think asked the question, or maybe it was Ms. Swedeen, on the lack of clarity about one metric versus both metrics being included. And I'd have to say I'm especially concerned about how percent of water type modification forms that are within this threshold value but were noted to be incomplete, lots of transmission errors, whether or not they're sufficient to be implementing a proposed change of this magnitude. Or perhaps even of testing for their efficacy to support a permanent rule, since it isn't clear that the threshold is where the test should begin. I think of the old story of looking for your keys under the lamppost when you lost them in the house, because there's light in the lamppost and not under the lamppost, but not in the house. In short, this report, while Iowa acknowledges a substantial effort, given the timeframe that was allowed, I don't really think it's ready for prime time. If I were doing a peer review for publication, I would have similar sorts of questions and concerns, and I would require that they be addressed prior to taking any recommended action. I think we want to set the science up, the validation study, to give answers that reflect where fish habitat stops. So I'd urge you to do the same. And I just want to acknowledge these guys did a mammoth amount of work in a very short period of time, and that compression forced them to make decisions that they may not have made had they had a longer period of time to really look at that data. Thank you.
Johnson. And John Gold, coming up after that. Sure.
Good morning, Chairman Burnett and members of the Forest Practice Board. My name is Michael Johnson. I'm a harvest manager for Hancock Forest Management in Northeast Washington. Thank you for allowing me time today to present testimony related to the work being done with potential habitat breaks. One of our key principles at Hancock Forest Management is environmental stewardship. We take our responsibility to try to meet the needs of all stakeholders very seriously. Over our three decades of timberland ownership and management in Washington, we have spent significant time and effort to restore fish pastures on our road systems and to establish buffering regimes on streams. Looking ahead, we believe it is critical that decisions related to establishing stream typing be based on sound current science from as wide a geographic area as possible. Eastern Washington has some unique issues when it comes to establishing fish habitat. This is demonstrated by some of the differences that are in the current rules. Information from studies such as Cole et al. Referenced in the report may provide value in looking at criteria that will both protect fish and help minimize impacts. As such, we believe that this important science should receive further consideration. We also have concerns about the use of percent capture to evaluate various alternatives. While it may seem correct to lean towards solutions that capture the most known points, it's unclear whether this would also lead to a shift upstream that misclassifies non-fish waters at a greater rate. At Hancock, we try to do the right thing every day. In this context, we want to protect fish where they live. But as a fiduciary, we can't afford to protect streams where fish do not reside. The TFW is in agreement with shared responsibilities. It is our hope that the delicate balance does not get shifted too far in either direction, in this case to the overprotecting of resources due to the limited use of given available science. Finally, I would like to ask that the board consider the financial impacts that these alternatives will generate. There are multiple costs to consider: the cost of additional fish pasture structures for streams that are upgraded, the cost of additional timber volume that are left alongside upgraded streams, and the cost of additional silviculture operations that are impacted by more streams being buffered higher up in the watershed. It is our hope that a cost-benefit analysis, including a spatial component, will be done on various alternatives to better understand the impact of each alternative. Thank you for your time today and for your attention to this important matter.
Chair Burnett and members of the board, my name is John Gold. I'm with Sierra Pacific Industries, and I do have some written comments primarily focused on next steps ahead that I would like to introduce into the record. I'm going to focus my limited time here on some issues with data in the report, but just to highlight what I think the appropriate steps forward are. Sierra Pacific is a large forest landowner, and we rely on other private and state and other public lands for raw material source for our manufacturing facilities. As much as anyone else in this room, we're committed to providing clean water, compliance with the ESA, harvestable supplies of fish, and economic viability. To that end, we think that it's incumbent on you to conduct a full economic analysis of any proposed rule changes or deviation from the current system, current rules that are in place. And we think that it is important that the standards that are enumerated for the water typing system in the Forest and Fish Report and as affirmed by this board in previous motions being a highly accurate system, 95% accuracy in demarcating F from N waters, and an equal likelihood of over or underestimating any remaining error are critical analyses that have to inform your decision going forward. I would like to also thank the science panel for the efforts and obviously the expertise that they brought to this process. I want to make a few comments on the data that is in the report. There have been some questions about whether there's bias in the landowner data set, and I'm here to say that Sierra Pacific contributed data to that effort. We simply made our data that's already in the public record available for analysis. We didn't, to this day, I do not know which of our surveys were included in that effort. We simply, as an association, hired a consultant to compile and deliver that information. There was no screening or pre-selection of streams to be used. By contrast, in Table 3, in the panel's report, if you look, 42 to 99% of the surveys by ecoregion were rejected for various reasons. And I think the question of why overall only 25% of water type forms were deemed acceptable to include is a question worth asking. I have been involved in approximately 500 protocol surveys over my career. And I want to let the board know that the last fish is a measurable place on the landscape. It's based on ecological factors that are observable and measurable. However, the concurred end of fish habitat is additionally the product of regulatory process, which involves judgment and human bias and risk tolerance. And there are real differences between regulatory regions, which correspond fairly closely to the ecoregions in the report. And these are the product of individual stakeholder opinion. And you will find that those decision points vary between years. I think that needs to be considered in how the report is interpreted. And lastly, I'd like to point out that by looking at the concurred regulatory habitat break, we're using those metrics in the report as a surrogate for the PHB, which is supposed to be the starting point for the protocol survey. And those are two different points in the stream network and on the landscape, and it's important to keep that in mind. Thank you very much for your time.
Andrew Smith and John Ehrenreich.
Good morning, Chairman Burnett. Members of the Forest Practice Board. Hi, I'm Kendra Smith. I'm here representing WASAC today, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to make comments on the science panel's work we did on the tide-deck waters. And first, we'd really like to thank the science panel for their work and appreciate the struggle they had to produce the recommendations in the allotted time frame that they had. And we also acknowledge that their hope in trying to develop metric sets that would work around the state was a valiant effort, again, with the time frame and with the data. But unfortunately, the data appears to be very skinny and incomplete, making the results in the analysis fall short of producing any sort of confidence in selecting any one alternative that we've seen. And for that reason, we're asking you, the board, to look at a suite of alternatives as you move forward with this process, and as you do so, include the one from WFPA with the work they have been doing. We know that you also need to look at the requirement of the cost-benefit analysis that is brought up in Steve's letter and the balancing of risk. And in doing that, when you assess these alternatives, we firmly believe that you need to look at the benefit to the resource, you need to look at what the risk is to the resource, and you need to do that economic analysis all up front so that you have a thorough amount of information in front of you to make the best possible informed decision at the end of the day. It's crucial to counties that this work be done correctly because it significantly affects our resources and our communities. Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is John Ehrenreich. I'm a director of forest tax and economics for the Washington Forest Protection Association. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Administrative Procedures Act and the cost-benefit analysis that you'll need in order to be able to evaluate the alternatives that are brought forward by the science panel, and hopefully would include, to include an alternative that the WFPA has brought forward, as well as the no-action alternative, which you are required by law to evaluate. The Forest Practices Board is directed to implement the directives that are in the Forest Practices Act in the intent section, and also is directed to follow the Administrative Procedures Act in adopting new rules. And in the Administrative Procedures Act, you're required to produce a set of goals and objectives for which the rule is to meet. And those are supposed to be clearly identified and set forth in detail. And against that, against those goals and objectives is what you measure the cost and benefit analysis. Cost benefit analysis is a measure of what we would call social welfare, in the sense that social welfare is sort of the aggregation of everybody's welfare, your welfare, my welfare, groups of people, and so forth. And when you harm one individual, you subtract it from social welfare. When you have benefited an individual, you've added to social welfare. In economics, we talk about Pareto optimal moves. With Pareto optimality would be where you are able to make some person or a group of people better off without making anybody worse off. This is, as you can imagine, rare in the regulatory environment, and instead we use a standard in economics called the Kalmar-Hicks, which is essentially the test is, can you make some people or person better off such that they could compensate losers even if they do not actually compensate them? The point being that you want to increase social welfare. Even if you make some people worse off, overall you want to have more social welfare, or at least conserve the social welfare. You do not want to dissipate the social welfare. Or in other words, do no harm. And I think that's the intent the legislature has. That's the basis for what's called a cost-benefit analysis. You measure the social benefits, you measure the social costs, and the social benefits need to outweigh the social costs. Costs to landowners would be mainly found in the form of lost productive acres, but there are also costs related to jobs that will go away if you reduce harvests, as well as taxes and other sorts of things that may be important to the local government. On the benefit side of things, you have basically how many additional fish are you going to produce, or how many additional fish are you going to avoid killing or harming, protecting. So the question is the costs that you see going to outweigh or be less than the benefits that you're trying to produce? One of the problems you're going to have here is that while costs are going to be relatively easy to determine because we have good market data regarding this, the benefits are not going to be nearly as easy. And we will need help from the scientists to try to figure out how many additional fish are produced or saved as a result of any kind of a rule change. Cost-benefit analysis, let me make one final point and I'll wrap it up. You have a challenge here in that a cost-benefit analysis always starts with the status quo, and then you measure the marginal changes. But one of the questions here is, what is the status quo? Is it the status quo of the rule as written, or is it the status quo of what we're actually doing out on the ground? As the many memo. This is a big question and could impact the sustainability of the rule if you try to pass. I would strongly suggest you calculate it both ways, where the status quo is both the rule as written and what we're actually doing out on the ground, and in that way, you sidestep that question, and you get to place in front of the board, who is the actual final, final body that makes the decision as to whether or not benefits exceed costs. The economists can give you evidence in the direction of whether the benefits exceed costs, but in the end, it's the board who has to make that determination.
Board members.
I just had a quick question on your comments. You had listed quite a few ancillary social considerations on the cost side. If harvest was to be reduced, but on the benefit side, you just limited it to fish. But wouldn't you also agree that there's a lot of social benefits and or social costs that go with reduced fish populations? So there's tribal culture, there's economics associated with harvestable fish, there's benefit to all of society for being able to have healthy fish populations and healthy aquatic ecosystems, right? So does not that also go into the cost-benefit analysis?
Those things that you talked about are generally wrapped up in what we call a willingness to pay. So economists, or the bigger economist, knows that when you generally try to establish through willingness to pay what something is worth. So there's all sorts of intrinsic benefits that are out there in culture, and the feeling that people like to go fish, recreational opportunities, all of those sorts of things, just the good feeling that they have inside, that knowing that fish are properly protected. All of those things are indeed important, and part of it is generally wrapped up in what they call the willingness to pay.
And I would also say there's willingness to accept. I mean, that's another measure, and willingness to accept the loss is usually different than willingness to pay. And so we can quibble about that as economists, but I just wanted to point out that it's there are broader considerations on the fish side than just how many fish you're going to save or not save.
Yes, we can, as you say, quibble about that later, and although most people enjoy having economists, watching economists argue. So we could do that for a while.
Okay.
At the bar.
Thank you. So I'll just remind those coming up for public comment, this is supposed to be about the science panel report and not about how staff will be doing the economic analysis coming up,
which we will have a presentation on this afternoon,
and board members can ask questions of staff at that time. Jim Peters and Debbie Cave, please.
Chairman Bernaff and board members, my name is Jim Peters, Northwest Indian Fish Commission, representing Western Washington Tribes. It's always a pleasure and an honor to come in front of you guys to speak on behalf of valuable resources here in Washington State, and I thank you for your service of participating in this public process. So, I will also want to thank the science panel for the work that they have done. However, at this time, the Western Washington Tribes will not be able to support the options that came forward. After reviewing the report, we believe that this does not protect low gradient systems, which are very important for coho habitat and potential habitat as fish stocks are recovering. As you know, salmon is very important to the tribe's culture and the treaty rights, and that the tribes here in Washington it's a way of our life, and we see it continuing to go down. Our salmon stocks continue to decline, and we all need to make sure that as the stocks and the efforts that we're putting into restoring these stocks and fixing not only Puget Sound but the in river systems, that there's habitat for those fish as they recover to come back to. And this is one of the things that we think that you'll hear a little bit more about tomorrow in our Western Washington proposal or recommendations. And also using what the panel has provided. We didn't want to completely throw out what they have, but we're really focusing on this, the low gradient type of systems where fish are important to be protected. I'm not an economist, but I do know that the timber companies are still making money, and unfortunately, this is the first year that I have not fished because of the lack of resources that are out there. And in probably the last 5 years or so, it's been my capabilities to be able to go out and fish have been less and less throughout the years. And so I know that that's not an economic analysis that you guys do, but it is a big impact, and our fishermen are continuing to cut back on its harvest to make sure that we are getting spawners back in the limited habitat that's out there. So thank you very much, and I'll hand it over.
Thank you to the board. My name is Debbie Kay. I am a forest practice coordinator for the Suquamish tribe, and I've been working for 8 years in adaptive management as well. I want to thank the panel. It was a big ask to take the data that was there and come up with something. It's not easy. I've read many of those water type mods, and it's not easy to use them to come up with something conclusive. That said, the area that we have, that I have specific concern about, is one of the areas they weren't able to get to, which is the lowlands of Puget Sound. In that area, the headwaters are different. They stay at a low gradient. They don't go up foothills. And because of that, they are lower velocity. They are home to a large proportion of our natal anadromous fish, which means that you will find coho-like small streams 2 feet and under. But if you are there at the wrong time of year and you're electrofishing one time, you're going to miss them. Excuse me. So because you have a higher risk with a single pass electrofish of anadromy, I believe it requires additional protection. This is more important now than ever because Seattle sprawl has come to many of the lowlands. This is an area with shared land risk, so there's development pressure, and many of those development entities are using the same water type rules as we are and deferring to this WAC in order to make their decisions. I think it's difficult. I think they did a good job trying to bring the information in, but in these lowlands, the data is limited, and the data not in this important area can be overwhelmed very easily by the other information. And I think tomorrow I'll be happy to answer questions about the other proposal as well. But I believe that any decision moving forward, it is my hope that you'll consider this area in particular as a particular high risk area in this rare forest niche.
Chris Mendoza and Ray Ed.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning, and welcome Chair and Board Member Davis to your first official meeting. Today, I just wanted to make some clarifications about the PHB report as recommended by the chair. But first, I want to thank the panel for doing what the board asked them to do relative to the last meeting by increasing the sample size and moving it across a statewide area where the rule will be applied. And I'd like to kind of back up and just also remind the board how this exercise plugs into FHAM. Everyone's been mentioning FHAM. And that NetHam started out as a stakeholder-driven process that we started, Conservation Caucus, with WFPA and other stakeholders on our own, come to agreement on a process by which you could type streams.
And I don't want those agreements to be overshadowed by differences that may exist on how you create these habitat breaks, which are designed to plug into the FAM. And so the first thing I'd like to address is the panel, while they did a lot of work in a short amount of time, I think there was some confusion on some of the results that came out of that, mainly due to nomenclature that was used, that we're used to using in different ways. For example, they use end of fish a lot, and the whole purpose of this exercise is to get away from end of fish and to actually start using the first fish found so that you can reduce the electrofishing. And that's kind of the point, and was one of the major gives from WFPA was to reduce electrofishing by moving above these PHBs, and as soon as you find one fish, you're pretty much done. You pull the electrofisher out of the water and you just walk until you find the next PHB. Well, that's a reduction in your fishing, as opposed to continue to find the last fish. So, while the intent, I think, was to depict that in the report, I think that there was some confusion about it. Starting at known fish has been used interchangeably with end of fish, and that is, I think, what led to that. And so when you start your survey, it just means you have to know where fish are, right? You don't want to start in an area where you don't know where fish are. That could be deemed through access, CF database, the state database. You may put your wand in the water and say, okay, I know fish are here. So that's sort of where you start the survey. Concerning the end of the survey, that's where the protocol e-fishing method that's in Board Panel 13 now spells out that you go a quarter mile and you not find fish. You can think of that as sort of your insurance policy to make sure that you've gone far enough to detect the fish that's not there. Now think about if you shorten that length, in other words, say you went, instead of a quarter mile, you went half that, you went an eighth of a mile, your ability to detect the fish there would be reduced. Because you're not going as far. It's kind of like I have kids, so I was playing hide and seek the other day. I was trying to explain this to my kid in school. It's like, well, you're playing hide and seek, and you guys hid outside and inside, and I was only going to look inside. I'd miss half of you outside. I wouldn't be able to detect you. And it's sort of the same thing with fish. If you don't, if you're only looking inside and not further upstream, you may not ever detect them. So I think it's important to note that as you tinker with how you prove absence, that they're not there, that's directly linked to how conservative you are on these PHBs, right? In other words, if you were to shorten that distance to mitigate the fact that you wouldn't, to mitigate for reduced detection, that you wouldn't be looking where you should be, you probably want a really big PHB to ensure that, you know, there's a good chance that fish won't be able to get up there. So I mentioned this because earlier I heard that that protocol survey could be anything. It could be a number of things. I think it was, a million things or whatever. But really, it's directly linked to how you define a PHB, because you want to make sure that that distance you go is far enough to ensure that you're not going to find fish. And that was agreed to in my closing statements by the initial FPAM stakeholder group. Thank you for your time.
Chair Benath, board members, I'm Rance. I'm here with the Kalispell Tribe and UCUT. Chris took my 3 minutes, so I'm kidding. I work gray for a reason. Not everything's black and white. You're faced with some tough choices. I want to applaud the work that the science panel did, especially Hans as the Adaptive Management Program Administrator and Dr. Rooney as the chair. I think they pulled off an incredible feat with a high amount of integrity, and scientifically, I'm pretty proud of what they were able to do. I think knowing that, you guys are faced with, nobody's happy, right? Shocking, but neither am I. But I think your strength is landing in a space where you have a solid recommendation based on data and scientific. Your strongest footing is on solid ground. Follow the science, follow the recommendations, move forward, validate, and amend with the results of the validation. Do that, and I think you guys are fine.
Thank you. Jason Walter and Jamie Glasgow.
You can put us down with the odd couple in the room.
You're really cute, odd couple.
Good morning, Forest Practices Board members. My name is Jason Walter, and I've worked as an aquatic biologist for Whale Watcher Company for almost 23 years. In this role, I'm responsible for managing the water typing program for Whale Watcher, overseeing the implementation of over 500 surveys a year on average. We see a very high concurrence rate on the water type models, for which we are the proponent in large part because our processes and protocols have been developed over the last 17 years in cooperation with our regulators from state agencies, such as DNR, DFW, and Ecology, along with affected tribes. These protocols recognize not only current fish distribution, but also habitat that is similar to and accessible from the habitats where fish are found, and therefore likely to be used by fish. In addition to managing the Whale Watcher Water Typing Program, I was a member of the Multi-Stakeholder Fish Habitat Technical Group, or the FHTG. This group was responsible for developing the FHAN, and I, along with other stakeholders, I think including Jamie, were really encouraged in 2017 when the board voted on the approving the FHAN framework as the basis for the new and permanent water typing system. It's one that would be implementable, repeatable, and enforceable. As a reminder, the primary tenet of the FHAN framework is that it is a stepwise approach to water typing that incorporates the identification of potential habitat breaks as acceptable locations to establish a type FHAN break. Language from that FHAN report clearly states that PHBs are defined as permanent, distinct, and measurable changes to in-stream physical characteristics. PHBs are typically associated with underlying geomorphic conditions and may consist of natural barriers that physically prevent fish access to upstream reaches, or a distinct and measurable change in channel gradient, size, or a combination of the two. In addition, the motion passed by the board in May of 2017 included the following language as guidance for the science panel in developing specific PHB criteria to inform the already adopted FHAN process. Determine those physical, biological, and chemical elements that would individually or in combination constitute a high probability that the PHB is coincident with a significant change in habitat, including stream size, stream gradient, the interaction of size and gradient, and the presence of barriers that limit accessibility. The recommendations presented by the science panel that PHBs should be associated with single threshold values for stream gradient and or size is inconsistent with the original intent of the FHAN. These fresh threshold-based PHB metrics would result in the consistent misidentification of habitat likely to be used by fish on both ends of the spectrum, providing no protections for potential fish habitat in many cases where it is warranted, while at the same time extending the type FHAN break upslope in other cases when it is not actually necessary to provide protections for habitat likely to be used by fish. Board Member Nelson asked earlier about the differences between potential habitat breaks based on change versus threshold values. I just want to run through one really quick example before I finish. Using one of the threshold-based PHB recommendations included in the science panel report as an example, a threshold-based gradient PHB, for example, of 10% would allow for the establishment of a type FHAN breakpoint along a stream channel where the stream gradient changed from 9% downstream to 10% upstream. Such a point clearly does not represent a significant change in stream habitat characteristics, and there is no reason to assume that it would be biologically meaningful to the movement of fish. On the other end of the spectrum, this same threshold-based gradient PHB of 10% would not identify a PHB at a point along the stream channel where the stream gradient changed from 11% downstream to 19% upstream. This would function to potentially ignore permanent, distinct, and measurable changes to in-stream physical characteristics that were in fact biologically significant once the recommended threshold value had been met in a given system. Essentially, the threshold-based PHB recommendations provided by the science panel result in a lose-lose scenario when attempting to inform a system that accurately identifies habitat likely to be used by fish. While I appreciate the work of the science panel, the aforementioned concerns are on some of the longer list of issues we have with the science panel report and the subsequent threshold-based PHB recommendations. As a member of the Technical Stakeholder Committee invited to provide comments on the PHB Science Panel draft report back in December, I summarized these concerns and issues in writing and submitted that information at the AMPA on December 22nd. That information is included as an addendum to my testimony. So in closing, as a field professional responsible for implementing the board's final decisions regarding new water typing rules on the ground, I would like to reemphasize the need for a system that is not only implementable, repeatable, and enforceable, but also accurate. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony today, and I look forward to continuing working with other stakeholders in the near future to find solutions to the issues you're hearing about today.
Chair Bernath, members of the board, my name is Jamie Glasgow. I'm here representing the Conservation Caucus. I am also Director of Science for Wildfish Conservancy, and we also do an awful lot of water typing, mostly in Western Washington, quite a bit in the Puget Lowland ecoregion. I understand you'll have a chance to ask questions of the panel. We don't really from this in this venue, so I have some requests for clarification that I'll pass on to you that I hope you will ask of the panel, because I think it will help inform your decision as you move forward. And some of these are just an elaboration and building off of some of the questions that Board Member Davies had mentioned. These are specific to the obstacle PHBs. Jason reminded us that that PHBs are, for this concept to work within the FAM, PHBs should be biologically meaningful to the movement of fish. And that's where our concern lies, in particular with the 5% inflection that's being considered and the obstacle definitions. So specific to the obstacles, we have all the while been under the impression that the obstacle criteria for PHBs were meant to be permanent natural features that were non-deformable. And that appears in some places in the report, but not everywhere. But those are really important concepts, and we don't want that to be lost. And if there could be some clarification that obstacles are permanent natural features that are non-deformable, that's for vertical and non-vertical obstacle criteria. The other clarification I hope you'll ask of the panel refers back to the scaling of obstacles. Dr. Roney mentioned the importance of scaling vertical and non-vertical of obstacles to the channel size or bankful width of a channel. The panel did make an effort to scale non-vertical obstacles to the channel width. However, vertical obstacles are a flat 3-foot step no matter the size of the channel that you're in, and I think we're missing an opportunity there, because a 3-foot step in a 2-foot wide channel behaves very differently when you're approaching it as a fish would than a 3-foot step in an 8-foot wide channel, for example. And so there is an opportunity to scale that non-vertical criteria to, I'm sorry, the vertical obstacle criteria to bankful width. And so we hope there could be some clarification on that opportunity tomorrow. Dr. Roney also reminds us that the 3-foot vertical obstacle exists as a flat 3-foot rate because they are applied in small headwater streams. And while it is true for the most part that the data that were analyzed to develop those criteria, the 3-foot vertical obstacle criteria, came from small headwater streams, it is not necessarily true that they will be applied in small headwater streams. By virtue of the FCAM, the way the survey works is working our way from downstream to upstream. And so we may encounter a 3-foot step that's well below the headwaters in much larger streams. And there again, I think, is good logic for considering a scaling of that vertical obstacle to the bankful width instead of a flat 3 feet across all stream sizes. I'll end with that and save some of my remarks for tomorrow.
Board Member Nelson, can I ask one question?
Sure.
You talked about the 3-foot
vertical obstacle, and it depended on the channel width, and that wasn't covered in the report. And Jeff talked earlier that one of the criteria that Fish and Wildlife uses is not necessarily the channel width, but the depth of the plunge pool below it. Is it your feeling that the plunge pool depth should also be part of the parameters that we looked at and maybe didn't?
I think the point Board Member Davis makes is that it is complicated. And there are probably a number of other factors that we could consider when trying to identify a rule or for a PHB, a vertical barrier PHB, for example. Water temperature could affect the fish's ability to jump higher or less high, depending on the water temperature. Bear with me here. But there are a number of different features that could be considered physical and chemical. I think the short answer is trying to find this balance between what's implementable and enforceable and repeatable, as Jason said. That's what we're interested in. When we started this process, we had a long list of almost 20 factors that we thought would be important to knowing how fish might access different types of habitats. And we've narrowed that down more or less to three. We could add more back, but in doing so, we add some complexity, and I think it becomes a challenge knowing where that sweet spot is.
I'm not advocating making this more complicated, trust me. Can I get Jason to answer the same question? These guys' arms are all scratched up. These guys actually do the work out there, and I want to know, is that a factor that we should have in the science panel?
I don't think that, specific information on jump pool depth typically is not provided in the water type mods that we submit. While there is some anecdotal information that is included at times, I think the thing to keep in mind is that per the board manual, what's deemed as an adequate pool for the purposes of protocol electrofishing survey is a pool that is 3 foot by 3 foot by 1 foot deep. And in most of the surveys that we do submit, there are no adequate pools encountered within a survey reach because we are dealing in small headwater streams. So at the very least, you can assume that quite often you're dealing with a plunge pool depth of less than a foot. I think it's about as specific as I can believe you.
Thanks.
If I could circle back to Board Member Nelson's question real quick, that also is a good example, I think, of the kind of information that could be collected during the validation study. Maybe one of many pieces of information we wish we had now, but we don't. But it could shed some light on how we make decisions in the future.
Thank you. Aaron Skurlock and is it Randy Lumper?
At this time, I'd like to withdraw my request to make comments. My comments were encapsulated in those who spoke before me, so I don't feel the need to reiterate them at the expense of the board's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy.
Do I have 6 minutes now? My name is Mary Skurlock. I'm the policy representative for the Conservation Caucus, and I will follow the rules that have been set up by everyone today, which is not to talk about specific alternatives, but to stick to things related to the report. But I am going to stick to the sort of how I'd like for you all to think about the report and the way that we're thinking about the report. The first thing I'm going to say is please don't be distracted or confused by reference to procedural requirements today. We should have those discussions. Maybe people's lawyers should talk to each other, but there's an order of operations, and today and tomorrow we need to focus on filling in the blank in the fish habitat assessment method that you've already adopted. And I feel that it's counterproductive to focus just on the PHB decision and then put the entire weight of the APA and CEPA and anything else you want to throw at it on this one metric, when in fact the alternative that we're talking about is the whole FHAM and the other stream typing elements that you've already approved. So that's a package that's going to need to be analyzed and all the I's dotted and T's crossed, and I have faith that DNR will do that, and I have faith that all the stakeholders will make sure that that is done. But please don't be distracted by that today when you need to be focusing on what is a method that is reasonable and that is supported by the record, which unfortunately is not a record full of perfect information, but is the best available information. And that information should be considered with reference to the huge amount of expert resources that you have in this room today, not just the ones you've heard from just now, the ones you're going to hear from in a few minutes, you can ask them questions. Don't just look at the printouts in the table. I think there have got to be other considerations, because after all, this is public policy. So this is the time to do that, and please make use of those resources. But having said that, you are empowered to make a decision, and I think you are empowered to make a clear and decisive decision. And I implore you to try to settle on a rule concept that can go forward to rulemaking that is not a suite of alternatives, but is in fact an alternative that is a defensible implementation of the goal that you have set out to identify fish habitat, including unoccupied and restorable habitat, something that you have already found as a board is not happening under the status quo. So there's an urgency to that, and we hope that you will use the resources, including the excellent tribal resources that have also come up here today, to defend the public, the great, important, and valuable public interest in fully implementing your fish habitat mandate. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter Goldman, Aaron Fluger. Thank you, Peter. Aaron?
I was waiting to be the oddest couple.
I always do
Thanks for asking. Who's lost your job, Karen?
There will be a rebuttal, I'm sure. Good morning, and being one of the last speakers before lunch, I am very cognizant of the time. For the record, my name is Karen Terwilliger. I'm the senior forester with the Washington Forest Protection Association. I really appreciate the opportunity to address the board today, and I also wanted to thank the science panel, as well as our stakeholder group that the technical stakeholder group that did a huge amount of work, not just on the fish habitat assessment methodology, but also really tried to provide good quality comments to this process moving forward. I'd like to talk about just three things. First is just to talk a little bit about the context, and notwithstanding Mary's testimony, I think it's really important for the board to understand what's next in the process as well. There are requirements, as have been noted earlier, under the APA to deal with costs, benefits, and to identify the least burdensome alternative. There's also a really important water typing objective that has to be met, and that is that any method to assess water typing needs to be accurate in the context of the forest and fish report, and needs to be able to share the responsibility or the remaining uncertainty. And I just wanted to read something to you from it's from the biop that was put together, I believe, by either National Marine Fisheries Service, and I think there's also one in U.S. Fish and Wildlife's remarks as well. And it says, failure to correctly identify fish-bearing waters will occur and is assumed to lessen over time. It assumes that any methods used to map or delineate such waters will have an approximately equal probability of identifying waters as fish-bearing, where fish do not actually occur, or the reverse, identifying waters as non-fish-bearing, where fish do actually occur. It is further assumed that such errors will be relatively small and largely offset at the landscape scale. This assumption is based on the fact that this concept of equal error probabilities was inherent to the Forest Practices HCP. The reason I bring that up is because as you move into this next step, understanding the implications on the ground of these PHB alternatives will be critical, both in understanding what the benefits for fish and all of the other societal benefits that have been talked about have been, and also the costs of those changes. Second thing I wanted to mention, and actually been mentioned quite a bit, so I'm not going to dwell on it, is the data and analysis concerns that we have with the PHB report. I also think that the science panel did a yeoman's amount of work in a very short period of time. Landowners also did a great amount of work during the last summer in a very short amount of time, putting together a data set that is actually 2 to 3 times larger than what the state was able to come up with during this time period.
you've heard this before, the watertight modification forms are not built for doing this kind of analysis. And so there were great challenges for the people that were doing all the data mining, and really appreciate them as well. Many of those were on that technical stakeholder panel. So I'm just going to summarize the concerns that we have. Number one, that the data set, the new data set, is not as representative as the landowner data set. It may be more dispersed, but in terms of the types of streams that are covered, the new data set severely underrepresents laterals. Secondly, in the fish, points are only in the database as far as I can tell, and I'm not the data expert, but as far as I can tell, is they're coincident with the end of habitat call. And so that severely restricts the amount of information that's available for this analysis. Third, and for many of the end of habitat measures, there are downstream measures either of gradient or of size that are missing. And it looks to me like somewhere between a third and half of those points downstream are not in that data set. So the conclusion is that this data set is incomplete. Now, it's not a bad data set, it's just more incomplete than the data set you had previously with the landowner data set. And we were anticipating, based on the board motions that were adopted about 6 months ago, that those data sets would be pulled together. You've heard a little bit about thresholds versus ratios and changes, so I'm not going to go through that. I think that Jason Walker did a great job. And then finally, just thinking about this statistic that's being bandied about, percent captured, in terms of the number of points that are captured with certain lines on a graph. It's really a summary statistic. It is not an analysis, and it's not a reliable measure of accuracy. You may be able to capture a number of points by moving those lines around, but it doesn't tell you anything in terms of how accurate those lines are. So just the third thing that I wanted to state, there's been a couple of mentions of an alternative that WFPA is putting forward. You should have received our alternative in the email that we sent out last night. It's also in my packet, it's on page 4. And what we're really interested in is taking a look at the science that is surrounding what information and data we have, and look at an assessment of alternatives. Under the Administrative Procedures Act, alternatives analysis is called for, and it really, I think, would behoove the board to select a number of PHBs, and it doesn't have to be a large number, to be able to actually look at the impacts on the ground of the economic analysis, the benefits analysis, and then the impacts to small businesses, as well as what the implications are for implementability on the ground. So you'll see the alternative here, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to say anymore. Except that we're asking for a spatial analysis to be done in terms of a concept that we've been working with the tribes that would create the naturalness floor of some kind. In your packet, you have the type of analysis that we'd like to see done, which is to look at various watersheds and then look at different gradient breaks. And if you take a look at those maps, you'll see why that information is so important. So thank you very much, and I appreciate your time.
Good morning, board members and Chair Burnett. I'm Peter Goldman, Washington Forest Law Center, working with the Conservation Caucus. Thank you for your attention to this really complex but important issue. I was going to wave, but I want to just keep this really high level. It's really, really important for the board not to get bogged down in the complexity of this. Today, as we wrote in our letter dated February 9th, we have a rule that allows landowners to use the electronic protocol, the e-fishing method, to exclude potential fish habitat under a protocol survey method in a board manual. Not even a rule, in a board manual. But as our memo said, this board manual 13, the fish use determination provision, and I put in quotes, fish use determination, it recognizes actual fish presence, not potential fish presence. So the goal and objective of what we're going through here is to just simply make this process more accurate, to better reflect potential from actual fish habitat. That's all we're trying to do. We're not trying to rewrite new rules. We're not trying to do, we're trying to just say what's in a board manual that was assigned 17 years ago. We're just trying to bring that a little bit more up to date, since we're not using a model now to predict what is and what is not fish habitat. So let's just keep our eye on that goal. How the board's job here is to determine how can we improve upon a site-specific board manual application process in the field that doesn't have the kind of data that Karen just referred to. It doesn't have any of those data points and spatial analyses, and nor does the default. We have a very imperfect system in place right now that is very ad hoc in watersheds and very subjective. And we're just simply trying to say, how can we improve on that a little bit more to recognize that we're probably e-fishing areas that are potential habitat but just don't have fish on the days that the survey's there. So let's not, there's going to be plenty of administrative process as the rule proceeds. A lot of caucuses have come together and have gleaned what we believe are the best data from that that most conservatively represent those points. I urge this board to just choose one, move forward, do the comparison required under the APA, and SEPA if necessary, absolutely. But let's just keep our eye on the goal here, which is to improve on a very arbitrary board manual process that's been around for 17 years. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, given that it's lunchtime, what I'd like to do is, yeah, how quickly do we think we can lunch?
That's 20 minutes.
We do it in 45. All right, let's break and reconvene at 45, and then we will have an opportunity to question the panel based on some comments.